Good morning. Of all the issues both presidential candidates have used to point fingers at each other, ocean policy was missing until an open letter from 115 leaders in ocean policy pointed fingers at the candidates. Author and Blue Frontier Executive Director David Helvark joins us this hour with the response. And we check back with filmmaker Toby McLeod about what's happened since the release of his four-part series, Standing on Sacred Ground. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
I'm Bill Sage. Papahanaumokuakea research has revealed another submarine butterfly secret. We'll look at the newest deep-sea reef species. And while it's been said that life begins at 40, if that birthday is 48 years ago, it's still a win-win if you know what to do. Octogenarian Wynn Straub shares his life philosophy.
That's the conversation for Thursday, September 8. Now the news.
Good Thursday morning to you, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Bill.
It's really wonderful to be here, especially when you think in some belief systems that all grounds are sacred. But, you know, in modern life, a lot of people don't seem to recognize sacred ground anywhere.
Well, we're going to take it up on the conversation this morning and pick up a conversation that we started about 3 years ago. Now, over the last few days of the World Conservation Congress, we've talked with people from around the globe who face many of the same issues as confront Hawaii. Some of them are leveraging the power of film to influence policy. Toby McLeod has been doing that for over 30 years. We talked with him last when his four-part series, Standing on Sacred Ground, was about to screen in Hawaii. Part 4, Islands of Sanctuary, focuses on Aboriginal Australians and Native Hawaiians reclaiming land from the government and the military and resisting the erosion of culture and environment. It's a story that's clearly continued in the ensuing years since we spoke to Toby McLeod, who's back with us in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
You've come here to the Congress along with 20 others from around the world who are all involved with the Sacred Sites Project. Since we talked to you last, I mean, certainly you've watched the conversation and the debate over Mauna Kea heat up. How does all of this fit into the context of sacred sites versus world heritage sites, which we seem to put a lot of attention toward and say are worthwhile protecting?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. And the Standing on Sacred Ground films, in the film series itself, linked these guardians of sacred places who had never met each other. They were just joined by being part of a film series. When we saw the World Conservation Congress coming in Hawaii, with one of our stories being Kaha'olawe, we felt that bringing some of the folks that are in the films, plus others who are sacred site guardians here to deliver a message to the IUCN Congress, would be an effective way to advance sacred site protection. And the guardians feel that joining together and linking their stories not only unifies them, strengthens their movement, but also strengthens the sacred places that they represent. So we started by going to Kaha'olawe, and after a few days on Maui doing ceremony and sort of bonding as a group, we came over to the World Conservation Congress. And Mauna Kea is a classic example now of, over the years, telescopes have been built on a mountain that has supreme cultural significance to Native Hawaiians. And yet, that's a kind of just a slow erosion. So now when the 30-meter telescope billion-dollar project comes along, it's just one more telescope. But during that same 20 or 30 years, there's been a Hawaiian cultural renaissance. And if you look at Mauna Kea from an international perspective, you suddenly realize that Native people all over the world are asserting their rights. They've got the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People now. We're working on a motion over at IUCN to affirm the idea that sacred places are like World Heritage Sites. These are places of universal value. Even though they're locally significant, like Mauna Kea or Kaha'olawe, they're actually linked to places like World Heritage Sites globally, like the Grand Canyon, which also happens to be sacred to many tribes. So we're actually saying that these places are similar and that they deserve the same kind of respect and the same kind of protection.
in some of the World Heritage sites that exist now, there is still intrusion into those areas. There's still mining. There's still other activities that have been happening with that. So what really does it mean to be a World Heritage Site vis-a-vis the protection that many seek by looking at something as a sacred site?
Well, this is one of the great ironies we've been confronting at the World Conservation Congress, which is that it's all about protected areas, and a lot of these protected areas are actually not protected. Even World Heritage Sites, which is an international convention, an international treaty that includes the words no-go areas for extractive industry, 114 out of 229 World Heritage Sites, that's one-third, either have mining going on in them, oil and gas drilling or mining, or right around them. There's one called the Selous Game Reserve in Tanzania where the government actually redrew the border of the World Heritage Site to allow a uranium mine to go into, oh, it's just a small part of the, of this park. But that's an erosion of the idea of protected areas. And so if World Heritage Site, and in the United States, 12 national parks and wildlife reserves have drilling or mining going on in them. So the U.S. National Park Service is not safe from this threat. So we're working on a motion that says World Heritage Sites plus all other categories of IUCN protected areas, including sacred natural sites and territories of indigenous people, deserve that same kind of respect. And really, it's an acknowledgement that we've reached a point in this world where we're at a tipping point. It's not just climate change. It's the pollution of water and the trashing of species and the destruction of sacred sites. These are all interconnected issues. And we have to draw a firm line that says these are no-go areas for extractive industry, which means not just mining and oil and gas, but a commercial sort of industrial agriculture like palm oil or dams, or even tourism or hunting where you're going in and you're taking from
right.
these places.
Which is a tough thing for a lot of people, you know, to hear, because very often people have, you know, certain lines which they'll be willing to come up to and say, okay, maybe there shouldn't be mining, but does that mean I can't go into this area? What you're talking about is a very black and white, simple no-go. That kind of argument, too, is not really what we're hearing when it comes to Mauna Kea. There are some who've been just cleaved within the Hawaiian community in talking about that, because it's not just Hawaiians versus science. It's a sense of, well, how much is this going to impact the mountain itself? And how do you put all of that when you have such splintered ideas about this going into an idea of sacredness and a sacred site that, in your mind, should be protected at all costs as a no-go area?
We had an all-day symposium at the University of Hawaii yesterday, and there was an incredible two-hour panel. We had a couple of astronomers and a couple of Native Hawaiians, and they were in dialogue, and it was incredible, about the meaning for science for this place in the beautiful night sky to have a telescope that can see out into the universe. But what was important was that the Hawaiian voice expressing why Mauna Kea is culturally significant and ecologically and energetically significant, not just to Hawaii, but to the entire planet. Just to have that voice articulated and recorded and heard and transmitted and in dialogue with the scientists, I think that's an important evolution. It's not that tourists shouldn't go to the top of Mauna Kea, but it's the cultural idea that this place is so culturally significant and it's so powerful that it's a place for human beings to visit and then leave, and not leave any impact. That idea all by itself, that humans should show restraint and not assume that we can go anywhere and do anything, just that idea is something that indigenous people, I think, would like the West to just contemplate. Whoa, restraint, really? We can't do everything and anything we want to? Really?
Yeah, restraint versus mastery. Thank you so much for coming in. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks very much, Beth Ann.
Toby McLeod is the project director of the Sacred Land Film Project since 1984 and is based in Berkeley, California. He's been working with indigenous communities as a filmmaker, a journalist, and photographer for more than 35 years. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the life philosophy of an octogenarian. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolawe, uhawai.
All this week, we've been highlighting natural wonders in need of protection. For this morning's quiz, we're looking at a natural wonder here in Hawaii, a brackish hot pond on the Big Island. This park's main destination is a large spring-fed thermal pool whose clear waters draw swimmers and fish alike. Conveniently placed steps allow for easy access to this lava rock pool, which is warm year-round due to the island's active Kilauea volcano. As rain falls on the island's wetter windward side, water is absorbed into the ground. It naturally dissipates towards the edge of the land and flows into the ocean from a number of springs. On the way to the sea, the groundwater flows through lava rock heated by magma from Kilauea. One of these naturally formed springs is the source of this man-made pool, which fills with warm water welling up from cracks in the lava on the pool's bottom. It's held in place by a concrete wall that keeps out the pounding surf, but allows for salty ocean water to mix with the warm fresh of the spring. For this morning's quiz, can you tell us the name of this remarkable swimming hole? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Abel Coelho from the Ruined Map Dance Company. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
When he turned 16, it was the day before his nation Germany surrendered to the Allies in World War II. His only prayer was to survive to be twice his age, 32. And now that he's 88, he's had his prayers answered far beyond his wildest dreams, and he's made many people's lives far better because of it. His latest book, Superb Seniors, is dedicated to those whose life experience makes them far more than what youth-oriented society dismisses as senior citizens, and he's got some very valuable insights. It's a pleasure to welcome author, businessman, and philanthropist Wynn Straub to the studio. Aloha, Wynn.
Hi.
So here you are today, and you were thinking, think back to that moment when you were 16, and you decide, oh, if I can only make it to 32, and then when 32 came, you went, oh, well, if I can only make it to 64. And yet you kept going. So I guess what would be a good starting point is, what do you think your secret has been?
No secret. Just staying alive and just doing what needs to be done at the time. As a matter of fact, I think it is a problem for people who spend too much time on making all kinds of fancy plans, while in fact they should be dealing with what's on hand, what needs to be done now. And so looking back at what I did, I just kept doing what needed to be done at the time and lived for that day and maybe to get into the next day, and that's all.
You have also remarked that people don't seem to live the way animals do, in the sense that once an animal is born and grows, it lives its animal life right up to the day it dies and doesn't really retire. You think retirement is a mistake in many cultures?
I think so. I think that it is the idea was born by humanity taking up agriculture. and maybe by industrialization, because we, instead of being hunters, gatherers, which we used to be, we became more robotic. Mm-hmm. And more machine than human in attending to particular tasks which had to be done and keep doing them again and again. And as such, of course, which is a tiring process, physically as well as mentally, So the machinery, the robot work, will wear out or will depreciate in time. While if it were a human being pursuing his or her fun projects, he or she'd be prospering. As a result, society decided that, people at a certain age should retire. And this retirement should be sort of golden age of life where they would have to do nothing or close to nothing and do the opposite of what they were doing before. So, and in a way, it justifies the exploitation by rewarding them with free time.
A lack of anything to do, in effect.
But in my opinion, this is thoroughly unhealthy because we are not designed that way, and we are designed to have fun, to do what we like to do, and to accomplish things we want to accomplish. And so, therefore, retirement doesn't really fit into that at all. Therefore, I would say that retirement is the wrong idea.
So, for yourself, you found yourself in a position. I don't have to retire. I can do what I want, and I can help people by letting them know how I feel, and it might help them?
Yes, this is right. I personally have not lived this kind of life, looking forward to retirement, but instead I would like to live the life I was living whenever I was living it. And so it just happens that as time goes by, so I become chronologically older. But this doesn't mean that I can't do what I can do.
And what you have is the wisdom and experience. When you call them superb seniors, those people have reached a certain age. If you can just get them to remember the contributions they've made and what they can do for themselves and for others, that's the crux of it.
Yes, I think that aspect other societies like the Chinese, they have realized this a long time ago, that as people grow older, they do acquire more wisdom and maybe become more proficient in what they are doing. So as a result, for instance, in the labor force, they should be the most valuable contributors to whatever work they are performing.
So whatever the age, the important thing is for the person to realize, live life now and live as you have always lived.
I think that would be a good definition, yes.
Well, Wynn, thank you very much, and I hope that we can all continue living in the now and remember we are a species designed for happiness. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Author, businessman, philanthropist Wynn Straub's latest book, Superb Seniors, offers valuable advice to people who lived a good long time on how to continue making their lives wonderful. and for us younger folks to learn these lessons as well, because we all might become superb seniors someday too. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more information.
HPR sustaining members are part of a rarefied breed. They know that making sure the station has reliable, predictable monthly income means HPR stability and longevity, and it can decrease the amount needed to be raised during the pledge drives. Please become a part of this incredible group, HPR Sustainers. Call us at 955-8821 to join them, or you can donate at hpr@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, working to protect and manage Oahu's drinking water resources for life. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
After the cases of police misconduct that have been widely talked about in and out of the media, could it be that a new police commissioner believes enough is enough? That seemed to be the message at yesterday's meeting. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So was this really the first time that Chief Louis Kealoha and other top police officials were truly challenged by the commission?
Well, the way Nick Ruby, who covers, as you know, police for us, put it in his story, it's the first time they were openly challenged in public, you know, about problems that have been raised repeatedly. Certainly with us here at Civil Bee, we've written quite extensively about police misconduct. And Nick was genuinely and pleasantly, I might add, surprised at the aggressiveness of Loretta Sheehan. She's the former prosecutor who's now the new police commissioner. Kurt Caldwell appointed her. And it really turned yesterday's meeting into really an inquiry into the problems with the department's lax handling of police misconduct, something that we have not seen before.
From, you know, what we know of what happened yesterday, it seemed as if she was willing to go anywhere and everywhere in asking questions of Kealoha and others. Was that the case?
That was the case. She said that really this is supposed to be a place for a robust public dialogue. This is how it's supposed to be, is the way that she put it. That is the job of the police commission. As we have reported, the commission has sort of been hands-off when it comes to misconduct and dealing with Chief Kealoha, and Sheehan absolutely feels that is not the case. Among the things that she took up directly with Kealoha and other cops are, again, things that we've reported on. Remember that case of the two lesbians who were arrested
in a North Shore
grocery store because a police officer was offended by that. Another case involving racial discrimination against three officers. We heard more information about that. Remember the case where two hikers were allegedly beat up. Certainly excessive force seemed to be involved by police officers when they were coming back on their trail. In that particular case, there was no punishment meted out to those officers. The police commission people yesterday said there just wasn't enough proof. But boy, if you saw the photo of one of the guys who got beat up, it looked pretty convincing there. So all this kind of stuff, Sheehan feels there is nothing off limits to talk about. This is, in fact, the responsibility of the police commission.
And asking what has been going on with these police officers, whether they're on desk duty or what has been happening with them, which has been sort of difficult for some of us to find out. I mean, I'm thinking about the HPD officer who faces criminal charges for allegedly beating a guy after a road rage incident.
Right. Sheehan even took on Chief Kealoha himself, which, as we've also been reporting on, is in a bit of trouble under a U.S. Department of Justice investigation. Both he and his wife, a city prosecutor, possible public corruption, possible abuse of power. Well, we've now learned that several HPD officers say they've been served warning letters from the Department of Justice, and that could find its way into some sort of trial coming forward. So really quite an eye-opening meeting yesterday, and all for the public good, in our view.
And some folks were going to hope that that's going to be the new normal, since there's been so much conjecture about really, you know, what the commission would be willing to do or say in the public interest.
Right. Well, we'll see. There were other commissioners that seemed to be less forthcoming yesterday, but certainly a fresh voice on the police commission.
All right. We'll see what happens from this point forward. Thanks, Chad. We'll talk to you in the morning.
Okay.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. The calendar moved past Labor Day this week, placing the presidential race even more squarely in front of voters. But with all the issues that divide those candidates that we're looking at, well, there's not been much discussed about their views concerning ocean policy. David Helvarg, the noted journalist and executive director of the Ocean Conservation and Policy Group, Blue Frontier, caught that omission. He published a blog post about an open letter signed by 115 ocean leaders in business, science, conservation, and education. It asked for answers from both presidential candidates. David Helvarg is in our studio this morning with the response he received to his question, how should a fish vote in this election? Good to see you, David. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me. And it's not just a fish. 2 days ago, I snorkeled with turtle here, and last night walking saw a monk seal, and truth is, they can't vote. We're the ones who have to vote. And
So when this letter went out, which was last month, you did get a response from Hillary Clinton and not so much as a tweet from Donald Trump.
We're still waiting. It's hard to, you know, find it's his organization. His campaign is a little of a train wreck. And so we finally found the billionaire who's going to hopefully respond. In the interim, we did get a response from Hillary Clinton, who talks of the blue economy. She acknowledges climate change, pollution, overdevelopment, overfishing is taking a massive toll on our ocean. And we really feel like and she's talking about some solutions. She's talking about finally passing the Law of the Seas Treaty, which the U.S. Senate has been sitting on for literally decades, talks about adaptation for our coastal peoples facing the risk of sea level rise and more intense weather. Talking about sustainable and traceable seafood and targeting pirate fishing, which has become a global issue, which also includes human trafficking and slavery. It's kind of this merging of organized crime between all these issues.
And all those issues are part of ocean policy that we have seen come out of the Obama administration starting in 2010.
Yeah, with ocean policy and, of course, the expansion of the monuments. We're seeing a legacy that if she wants to claim, part of that legacy is restoring the blue in our red, white, and blue. And we think that it's vital that essentially it's much of the media has covered this as a horse race and beyond Hillary's emails and Donald's daily outrages. We really need to talk about the issues that are vital for our survival. And certainly people here in Hawaii, most isolated archipelago, understand that we're an ocean planet, that it's not. We get so much from the ocean in terms of, you know, recreation, transportation, trade, energy, protein, just that sense of awe and wonder, not to mention every other breath we take. You know, it generates the half the oxygen that we breathe. It's a driver of climate. It's all these things, and it's not been a major policy issue. So I don't think I'm going to, you know, we're going to succeed to make it at the level of immigration or education, but at least net neutrality. I mean, this is our largest public domain. Our public seas are vital to our economy. And Hillary in her letter talks about the blue economy, which is good. These are the issues that the public has to start thinking about.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that when Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli, was with us on Friday. But there seems to be a real disconnect from the idea that we are an ocean planet, and we don't think very much about the ocean unless it starts to impact usually a pocketbook.
Right. Usually people don't think because you look out of it, out at the ocean, if it looks beautiful, you don't think what's beneath and what's happening, the processes. But we're at this convention that's been this week, the IUCN, the Conservation of Nature Conference. People are talking about the crisis, you know, that it's really a cascading series of crises, from industrial overfishing to pollution, oil, chemical, nutrient, plastic pollution, to the loss of habitat we need for restoration. On top of all this, fossil fuel-fired climate change is literally changing the chemistry of the ocean. So you go out, and last time I was here, saw the bleached coral, and it was a global coral bleaching that's taking place. In her letter, Hillary refers to the bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef. But it's everywhere except where it's protected, where I was just in Palau in June. Healthy, you see an ocean as it should be. I call it shark-enhanced, not shark-infested waters, with healthy corals and large populations. And an economy like Hawaii that's dependent on tourism to see something that's healthy and alive, that also protects the islands as a storm barrier that generates food. They've protected 80% of their waters as no-take. And the president explained to me that the other 20% become more bountiful, because when you protect, you know, the heart of the sea, it comes back in so many forms. It improves our economy, our health, our sense of well-being. And these are the issues that, you know, the biggest story in the world right now is taking place here at that conference just down the street. And yet
You don't see crews lining up all down Kalakaua.
No, and yet survival, I mean, I started Blue Frontier almost 13 years ago because I'd lost somebody important in my life, and I got a call from Ralph Nader, who'd read my first ocean book, Blue Frontier, and he said, you know, ask if I wanted to start a nonprofit. At the time, because of my loss, I was thinking of going back to war reporting. This is when President Bush was sort of ginning up the war, the invasion of Iraq. And I thought when Ralph made the offer to reach out to create what I call the seaweed, the marine grassroots movement, I thought we're probably always going to have wars. We may not always have healthy reefs or abundant marine wildlife. And this is the critical battle of our days.
So let me ask you, how do you make that connection with people who are not used to looking at what's beneath, who have, in many cases, short attention spans, who are more interested in what's happening in entertainment and what may be happening outside their window and the impact of the ocean on their lives? How do you get that connection reconnected?
It's always a challenge. You have to work at many levels, media, personal. Just in my neighborhood, Richmond, California, we have 420-acre headland on the bay that we saved from a casino development. And now we bring our local high school kids. My community is low income. It's 40%, you know, Latino, 30% African American, 20% Anglo, 10%. So these kids in our high schools haven't been on the waterfront. We just have raised money and had field trips for the high schools, and the kids get out there. There was in the middle of one of the classes we had under a tree. They look out, and an osprey sea eagle came down and grabbed a fish out of the water. The kids went ballistic. You know, one of them were feeding them pizza on the way back to the benches. A couple of, this big, tough-looking 18-year-old kid starts shouting, and these two little girls with him, I run over, like, worried. And they've spotted a little fence lizard on the tree. And it's like, well, what do you think? It's like they're going, it's like a miniature dinosaur. You know, that sense. And they've all come back. They've had their senior sunsets there, their senior sunset events. And I'm seeing them with their families on the waterfront. It's so easy. Once you get people to the edge of the water, they start, their curiosity peaks. And you only protect what you love. So we have to connect people. We have to get them in the water. We have to make the connection that how much our economy, our ports, you know, greening ports, greening the ocean, bluing the ocean really is the way that we can still turn the tide. It's not too late.
That's a message of hope, and thank you very much for bringing that, especially at such a critical time. David Helvarg, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
David Helvarg is an author, and he's also the executive director of Blue Frontier, an ocean conservation and policy group. He'll be speaking tonight at the Books and Spirits event. If you'd like to know more, take a look at our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. All the details are right there. Thank you.
I'm Jeff Hamilton from the Clayton Hamilton Jazz Orchestra and the Jeff Hamilton Trio. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. It's the way of the world that the new supplants the old. Frequently, it's also the case that the old resurges and looks pretty effective. Next on Town Square, we consider how some Hawaii groups want more community-based natural resource management and consultation about the old ways before policies are set. Join us later today at 5 on Town Square.
Support for The Conversation comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting the 11th annual Ku Mai Kahula, a competition featuring halau from Hawaii and California performing traditional and modern hula. 1 p.m. this Saturday in Castle Theater. MauiArts.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Emissaries returning from long desert traverses tell us walking itself helped them find their place in the cosmos. One fellow I know trekked all the way across the Mojave Desert. He said the astonishing cactus blooms created an unforgettable visual feast. But most folks don't have time or the skills needed to walk across a desert. This is where Virginia Isbell and Gloria Blum come into today's story. They began the West Hawaii Fund. Comprised of local people and businesses in Kailua Kona, they became part of the Hawaii Community Foundation in 1990. One of their first projects was the Maka'eo Walking Path. Situated at the old Kona Airport, the path is surrounded by many flowering plants, especially the types of blooming cacti popular with desert adventurers. Because of the vision and generosity of the West Hawaii Fund, you don't need a month alone in the desert. You can get a taste of it during your lunch break on the Maka'eo Walking Path. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
Earlier today, we talked about a curious hot pond on Hawaii Island. We wanted to know the name of this brackish water swimming hole found in the island's Puna District. This pool, fed by a natural freshwater spring, is known for balmy year-round 90-degree temperatures, a happy result of volcanic activity. Groundwater from the island's rainy side is heated as it passes through magma-heated rock from Kilauea and eventually surfaces at springs like this one that empties into the sea. At this particular spring, a natural pond formed and was expanded with concrete to create a favorite destination for many in the area. In recent years, safety concerns have been raised after several people contracted bacterial infections after swimming in the pond. The pond is currently open again, and swimmers say that the ocean water flushes the pool, keeping it relatively clean. Its name? Ahalanui Pond, located in Lower Puna. That's the answer to today's backyard quiz, and nobody knew it, so we'll hang on to that t-shirt until tomorrow. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the backyard quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
If you don't know something is there, how do you know you're looking for it? Well, if the area is seldom explored, that's part of it. It being a previously unknown mesophotic butterfly fish, and mesophotic being the zone way down deep in the reef waters where the light barely penetrates, a true underwater twilight zone. Too deep for conventional dives and not deep enough for most manned submersibles, so we're just beginning to explore it in depth. NOAA coral reef fish ecologist Dr. Randy Kosaki joins us this morning. Aloha, Randy.
Hi, good morning.
So when the deep-sea submersibles don't really go there, that's why?
Well, they could work in that depth range, and we're talking about
probably 150 to 500 feet. So that's a lot deeper than most scuba divers go. And subs could work that depth range, but they can also work at 4 to 5,000 feet. So generally people take them as deep as you can, not as shallow as you can.
Does cost have something to do with it?
Cost is also a major consideration, that you're going to go as deep as you can when you're paying $40,000 a day for sub time.
So $40,000 a day.
They're great tools for exploration. They can go very deep, but they also have some shortcomings. They're not very good for collecting fish or for counting reef fish. If you were to try and do a reef count, a reef fish count from a submersible, it's kind of like trying to survey deer in the forest by driving a Hummer through the forest.
Gotcha.
You know, it's not subtle. It's big. It's noisy. Mm-hmm. So divers really are a very good tool for exploring coral reefs, much better than submersibles, actually.
But this mesophotic zone is almost too deep to go with normal breathing?
Yeah, it's very, very deep. It's too deep for normal scuba, so we use these so-called rebreathers that allow us to manage exotic breathing gas mixes that are custom tuned to whatever depth we're going to. So rebreathers allow us to adjust the gas mix on the fly.
So when you get there, of course, you must have lots of decompression to get back up.
Yeah, it's a long time coming back up for a relatively short time on the bottom. So if we were to do a dive to, say, 100 meters, 330 feet, and stay 20 minutes on the bottom, we'd spend 2 hours plus slowly working our way back up to the surface.
So it's really almost a voyage of unknown discovery. You take some pictures from deep sea, you just get a general snapshot of the area you want to study and just use the time as wisely as possible?
Well, we do some quantitative fish counts, actual fish surveys, so we can compare abundances of fishes. We collect specimens of things we don't recognize or can't identify on site, and some of these may turn out to be new species. Mm-hmm. And yes, we take a lot of pictures.
So when you're down there, the actual discovery of the deep water butterfly fish, how did that come about?
That actually goes back a ways, and it gets back to your question about submersibles. My colleague, who's a co-author on this, Rich Pyle from the Bishop Museum, actually noticed this butterfly fish over 20 years ago in video taken from submersibles. So the submersibles were diving at about 600 feet. But because that's a fairly extreme depth for scuba divers, it was many, many years before we were able to get good specimens of the fish in hand. You know, which points up one of the shortcomings of submersibles, is they're good for sightseeing, they're not so good for catching fish.
So at first it was, oh, what's a butterfly fish doing? And thought it was probably just a surface species that dive deep? Or?
Well, it looked like a species who's generally found in the Indian Ocean. But just on site, we couldn't determine whether it was that species or a new undescribed species. Mm-hmm. So it was many, many years until we were actually able to find them in some abundance at shallower depths, you know, quote-unquote, only 200 to 300 feet in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And we were able to get DNA out of those specimens, compare it to other known specimens, and it is, in fact, a very distinct species.
So what's known about its life cycle now?
Very little. Most reef fishes, including butterfly fish, have pelagic larvae, so they don't have parental care of their offspring. They spawn into the water column, and the current takes the larvae, so that's how they disperse between islands. And so we're assuming that's also the case for these butterfly fish.
Do the pelagic larvae stay at depth, or do thermals rise them and lower them? And
generally, they float to the surface and are carried by current, so they can drift anywhere from a couple of weeks to a couple of months, and in that time, they can disperse long distances. Now, Hawaii is pretty isolated. We're pretty far from any other coral reefs. And so thanks to that isolation, quite a few of our species that evolve here are unique and are only found here in Hawaii. And that's very likely the case with this butterfly fish.
So how many actual habitats in the Papahanaumokuakea, the entire area, or just very specific regions?
Well, we're finding this fish up at the northern end of the archipelago, and that in part is probably because the water gets cooler as you go further north. Mm-hmm. So things that tend to be deeper here around the main Hawaiian Islands come up a little bit shallower, and so that's why we've been able to collect several of these new fishes.
So the water temperatures at depth in the northern islands?
It gets cold. When we're doing 300-foot dives, we're hitting 56, 58 degree Fahrenheit water, and there's nothing tropical about that. You know, I went to college in California. That's California in November is 56 or 58 degrees.
So the reef, I mean, the growing zone of the reef is a lot closer. This is just more the old, the remains of the limestone skeletons down there?
Or? It's partially that, and there is live coral also at some of those depths. They grow more slowly than closer to the surface, but there are areas off of Maui, between Maui and Lanai, that have a 100% coral cover in 300 feet of water. So there are deep water corals, and these are deep coral reefs.
Are these the black jewel quality corals or just reef builders as
these
well?
These are reef building corals. There are also black corals at depth, but these are the reef building corals that we're talking about.
But eventually you reach an area where it's just too cold for any coral to sustain?
Either too cold or too dark, because these corals are also photosynthesizing animals. They have algae in their tissues.
Yeah.
And so somewhere in that 400 to 500-foot range, it's too cold and too dark, and then all you're left with are the black corals.
So, in effect, what happens? The Hawaiian Islands keep going, and they finally reach the Drowned Reef, and then the seamounts stay just because it's too cold and too dark.
Yeah, that's correct. The corals can no longer grow to keep pace with the subsidence of the islands, and so the islands submerge.
One final question. Who actually gets credit for discovering this reef fish?
Oh, Rich Pyle. He noticed it 20 years ago in submersible video, so it was a while before we could catch one, but that definitely is Rich.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in today, because it's actually a fascinating time to find out that there's a lot more down there that we're finding out about, and now we have the ability.
Yeah, there is. We're just scratching the surface, but thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Dr. Randy Kosaki, the coral reef ecologist with NOAA's Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. His research specialization in advanced dive technology, such as closed-circuit rebreathers, explores the coral reef twilight zone, the mesophotic zone. His research primarily focuses on remote reefs of the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. In his spare time, he skin dives, trolls, spears fish, cooks fish, eats fish, studies fish, keeps fish at home and in the aquarium, dreams about fish. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more information.
Today we're wrapping up our daily check-ins at the hashtag Nature for All Pavilion. Sean Southey is the CEO of PCI Media Impact and a member of the IUCN Steering Committee for the Commission on Education and Communication. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Good to talk to you again. Now, we've heard so much over the course of the Congress about protecting nature, which really starts with an ongoing exposure to it. How well will all of the hashtag Nature for All partners remain networked long after the Congress has finished to be able to keep that pressure from the bottom up on policy?
Well, one of the reasons we were excited to do this campaign in the framework of IUCN is it has 1,400 members, governments and NGOs, and it has over 16,000 individual experts involved in the commission. There is so much experience in helping people fall in love with nature in that community. And the whole entire idea behind Nature for All is to get the best practices, good practices of one region, share them with others so we can inspire, engage, and create a new culture of conservation that starts at the grassroots level and goes all the way up to our politicians.
So what's that process look like?
Well, we launched this week. And so we, in our wildest dreams, had hoped we might have 25, 30 partners to start. But clearly, this campaign has touched the hearts of IUCN and its members, because we now have over 110 members. We already see concrete commitments from the members to move forward. We have a meeting of over 200 young people happening in the next month in West Africa to explore Nature for All in the context of West Africa. We have National Geographic committed to bring every partner who's interested together in a planning meeting to see next steps.
And how about Hawaii partners?
I have to be honest. Today I am not at the Nature for All Pavilion. Today I'm at Kailua Beach. And I came here for the sunrise this morning, and I came with some of the volunteers and some of the people from Kupu. And they brought together with the Canadian Wildlife Federation 25 youth this week, a mix of Canadians and Hawaiians, who made their closing presentation at the pavilion. And it's one of the most touching moments I had, because to see these 25 young people who spent a week together crying with happiness as they separated to go to their respective places. I think we will find inside that Kupu community and the Canadian Wildlife Federation and many partners a renewed commitment to peer-to-peer learning, to sharing. And you could not launch this program in a more suitable place in the world than Hawaii, where so much of the culture is in love with nature.
Well, we're going to hope that that falling in love with nature continues and that this goes well beyond conference high. Sean, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us this morning with a wrap-up.
Always a pleasure. Keep up your good work, and lovely to be on public radio in Hawaii.
Sean Southey is the CEO of PCI Media Impact. And he is also a member of the IUCN Steering Committee for the Commission on Education and Communication. If you'd like to know more about hashtag Nature for All and its campaign, which launched at the Congress, see our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. And that is going to do it for us for this day. So much that we talked about, Bill, that has to do with the ocean today, and clearly talking to David Helvarg, worthy of our attention and needing much, much more of it.
Staying in the now and staying at depth and discovering whole new worlds.
We're going to talk more about those new worlds and what worlds may be opening up through the IUCN as it's going to be coming to a close on Saturday. We're going to speak with Dr. Sylvia Earle with her assessment of the conference and what the Congress may inspire as it goes forward. And also, we will have a wrap-up from Director General of the IUCN. That's all coming up tomorrow.
Plus, a new National Park Service study of the Pu'ukohola-Heiau on the Big Island.
In the meantime, you can be in touch at 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show or want to pass one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning right here with more of the Conversation.